This is Fresh Air. Our next guest on this special Father's Day salute is comic actress and writer Carol Leifer, who got an early start in comedy hearing her father tell jokes when she was a kid. She started working the comedy clubs when Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, and Larry David were getting started, and they became her friends. She later wrote for the NBC series Seinfeld and has starred in her own TV comedy specials. Terry Gross spoke to Carol Leifer earlier this year upon the publication of her memoir called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win.
Carol Leifer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Your opening essay in the new book is about your father, who recently died at the age of 86. And you write that he's the reason you wanted to be funny, because he was funny. And in this piece, you tell one of the jokes that he used to tell. It's a, quote, dirty joke that you didn't get when you were a kid. It's such a great joke, so I had to start by asking you to tell it.
Okay. Well, a guy goes to the movies with his pet chicken. And he buys two tickets, and the person says, who's going in with you? And he goes, well, my pet chicken here. And the ticket person says, hey, you can't bring an animal in the movie theater. So the guy goes around the corner. He stuffs the chicken down his pants, goes into the movies, and the movie starts, but the chicken is starting to get a little hot. So the guy unzips his fly to let the chicken stick his head out and get a little air. So a little bit of time has passed by, and a woman nudges her friend and says, you know, this guy next to me just unzipped his pants. And the woman goes, ah, look, you know, you've seen one, you've seen them all. And the woman goes, yeah, I know, but this one's eating my popcorn.
I love that.
Yes, hilarity ensues. But I remember as a kid, you know, my father telling this joke a lot and getting big laughs. And I was young enough that I didn't really understand it, you know, because all I heard was a chicken and a, you know, a zipper, and it didn't really make sense. I found out, you know, what the joke meant later, and that just might have been the thing that pushed me into lesbianism, but
which we'll get to later.
Yeah, I really, you know, my father was the king of the joke tellers, and I was so impressed as a child watching him hold people in rapt attention with these stories, and it had a big impact on me.
So did he actually collect jokes?
He did. My father, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he'd always say, throw at any subject and I got a joke on it. And he really, one of the high points of his life was my mom is a PhD in psychology, and she went to one of her psychology conventions, and the scheduled entertainment for that night had canceled. And the psychologist, knowing that my father was a big joke teller, asked if he would mind stepping in and telling some jokes. And as I hear it, you know, he was thrilled and delighted. And he, I think, told about a half an hour or 45 minutes of jokes, and he killed. And it was really a fantastic night for him. I think to my father's generation, to have a career in show business was not something that was accessible or something that someone actually did, you know. And I'm really happy that he lived long enough to see a lot of my success and was so happy for me. So it's, you know, it's nice that he left this earth, you know, having seen that and shared that with me.
When your father died, the family found a list of jokes that he kept in his wallet. Did you know that he had that?
I did know that he had that list of jokes. We all did, my brother, sister, and I, because, you know, it ties back to that evening that he entertained the shrinks at their convention. I know that he thought if they ever asked him to perform again, he wanted to be prepared. So he had his list of jokes there.
So when the family was dividing up his possessions, you got the paper with the jokes that you say you now keep in your wallet.
Yes, I do keep it in my wallet. And if I'm ever stuck at a show, I'm certain I will have no problem whipping it out and going through the list. I went, you know, I did a special many years ago. I think we spoke about it the last time I was on the show, called Gaudy Body and Blue, which was a tribute to these bawdy, dirty comedians of the 50s and 60s. And I had asked my father to put on tape every dirty joke he knew. And I think it's about 2 hours worth of jokes. And I'm so happy that I kept it, so that I really feel like I have my father's legacy with me, because he wasn't a pro, but he had excellent timing. He was an amazing comedian. And people who knew him, the first thing they always said about him was that he was so funny. And I talk about that in a piece, that I think if my father knew that being funny was the first thing that people said about him, that would be enough and make him happy, not having had a professional career.
Well, what he did for a living, he was an optometrist.
Yes, he was. He was. But, you know, he always shared funny stories about, you know, being an optometrist. You know, people would come in and he'd ask them, you know, can you please read the eye chart? And they would ask out loud, no, sir, you know, why don't you mime it for us? Of course, out loud. Or he would have people that would read the eye chart and go, capital E, capital F, capital, you know, it's like they're all capitals, okay? So, yeah, we, I miss him so much.
Now, you pointed out that your father and his friends never thought that a show business profession was anything that was in reach. But obviously you did, and you did it. So what made you think when you were young that it was within reach for you, that you could go, you know, be a professional comic?
I think because I started so young, it was a dream that seemed possible to pursue. You know, I started doing stand-up comedy as a junior in college. You know, my mother had said, I thought it was something that you'd get out of your system, you know. But I clearly remember my father saying, you know, Dad, I passed the audition at this comedy club and I want to transfer to Queens and try to become a comedian. My father's like, you know what, you got to strike while the iron's hot. And I think that was great advice. I think it was an opportunity not to be missed. But I do think the fact that I had still finished my college degree, that was important to my parents. And I think to my generation of comics, it was within reach. I think certently to my dad's generation. I remember asking him why he had never pursued it. And he said, well, you know, someone's got to make a living. You know, that generation, that it was a really far off dream and not within the realm of possibility.
Carol Leifer, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. Her memoir is called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win. Here's a great song Loudon Wade Wright III wrote for his daughter. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
That's my daughter in the water. Everything she owns, I bought her. Everything she owns. That's my daughter in the water. Everything she knows, I taught her. Everything she knows. Everything I say, she takes to heart. Everything she takes apart. Every time she fell, and that's my daughter in the water. I lost every time I fought her. Yeah, I lost every time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. For the second half of our Father's Day show, we've got three musical sons telling stories about their respective dads. First up, Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Gilmore is a singer from West Texas who writes songs that would be described as alternative country. But in 2005, 5 years after his father died of ALS, Gilmore recorded an album of classic country songs called Come On Back. It was dedicated to his late father and featured songs his father loved, including one by Jimmy Rogers, for whom Jimmy Dale Gilmore was named. Gilmore visited Terry in the Fresh Air Studios in 2005. He brought his guitar, and also brought guitarist Robbie Gerso, who accompanies him on the Come On Back CD.
Welcome, everyone, to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you here. Jimmy Dale Gilmore, this new CD is dedicated to your father, who died a few years ago. I want you to start with a song, Pick Me Up On Your Way Down. And what did this song mean to your dad?
Well, actually, it represents an entire style that I really associate with him. It's this old, it's honky-tonk dance music is what it amounts to. And it is one particular one that he really loved. I have this memory of him just, with his kind of head tossed back and with his eyes closed, just grinning when this kind of music was on.
Would you play it for us?
Yeah.
One, two. You were mine for just a while, now you're putting on the style, and you never once look back at your home across the track. You're the gossip of the town, but my heart can still be found where you tossed it on the ground. Pick me up on your way down. Pick me up on your way down. When you're blue and all alone, when their glamour starts to bore you, come on back where you belong. You may be their pride and joy, but they'll find another toy, and they'll take away your crown. Pick me up on your way down.
That's the way we fake being the band playing the song.
And that's Jimmy Dale Gilmore on guitar and singing Robbie Gerso, who's singing harmonies and playing guitar. And that song is from Jimmy Dale Gilmore's new CD, Come On Back. That sounded really great. As we mentioned before, the CD is dedicated to your father, who died of Lou Gehrig's disease. Did he introduce you to country music?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He was from my very... very earliest memories, that music was always pervasive. You know, it was radio. We didn't have a phonograph until I was actually in high school.
Wow, that's pretty late.
And but my dad, we always had the radio going, you know, and my dad played. So he would be sitting around the house playing his guitar along with the radio or actually, you know, sometimes playing that with bands for dances.
And you quote a great advertisement for a dance that he was playing, where he apparently he was one of the first musicians in West Texas to use a solid body electric guitar.
That's right.
So would you describe that ad?
Yeah, it said at this time when I was very small, we lived in Tulia, Texas, from the time till I was about 5 years old, and on a dairy farm, and my mom recently, you know, a few years ago, found a little clipping from the Tulia Herald, little tiny ad that said dance at the VFW hall featuring with the Swingaroos featuring Brian Gilmore and his electric guitar.
That's great. The Swingaroos.
Such a novelty.
So did your father teach you guitar or did you learn that on your own?
He taught me just a little bit. He taught me how to play Wildwood Flower. And the thing is that I fell in love with the acoustic guitar and my dad was an electric player. Mm-hmm. And I never did. To my regret now, I never did really learn to play the electric well. I can fumble through with it. But I just learned. My dad taught me a tiny amount, and then I kind of went off more in the folk and blues direction as I was learning to play.
I want you to do another song from your new CD, Come On Back. And the song I'm going to ask you to play is a Johnny Cash song called Train of Love. But tell us first how you first heard Johnny Cash and what he meant to you.
Well, I may have heard a few of his recordings on the radio a little bit. This was when I was very young. But my first real memory of it was my dad took my sister and I to see Johnny Cash with Elvis Presley. And I was about 12. I think she was about 10. And it was, I've often said that I suspect that that night completely determined the rest of my, I think that was one of those places where a little deflection happened, that I loved that music so much. I loved both of them.
Boy, I wish I was at that concert. It must have been really early in their career, right after they both signed with Sun Records, concert with Presley and Cash. Wow. Well, would you do that song for us, Train of Love?
Yeah, I will.
Train of love's a-coming, big black wheels a-humming, sweethearts waiting at the station, happy hearts are drumming. Oh, train men, tell me maybe, ain't you got my baby? Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Train of love's a-leaving, leaving my heart grieving, but early and late I sit and wait because I'm still believing. Oh, we'll walk away together, though I might wait forever. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore, visiting Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios in 2005. The CD dedicated to his father is called Come On Back. Here's another musical father-son story for Father's Day. Daryl Scott is an alternative country singer-songwriter who won an ASCAP Songwriter of the Year Award in 2002 and plays with Steve Earle's Bluegrass Dukes. Daryl's father, Wayne, is in his 70s and installs chain-link fences. When Daryl Scott became successful enough with his country music career to start his own record label, the first thing he did was pay tribute to his father. He produced an album of Wayne Scott singing mostly his own songs, the songs that Daryl heard his father sing when he was growing up. The album is called This Weary Way. Terry spoke with Daryl Scott and his father, Wayne Scott, in 2006.
Daryl Scott, Wayne Scott, welcome both of you to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you here. Daryl, when you started your record company, the first album you released was by your father. Now, you know, you're pretty well known in the world of country music. So why did you want your first record to be your father's music?
Well, I just thought it was important. His music is important. I know I'm his son and all that, and there's that going for it, but I really feel that his music is important just because it's so pure and true, especially to the form of really country music or mountain kind of music. I heard these songs all my life, and I know them backwards and forwards, and it was just time to finally get him to come and record these, you know, with a bunch of my friends down here in Nashville, or in some cases we went to him up in Kentucky in his living room, and I just thought it was time.
You've said that you used to think that all the songs he sang were by Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and other venerated songwriters. When did you realize a lot of those songs are his own?
Well, yeah, they kind of blended together because around the house he would do all of that. He'd do Johnny Cash and Hank and Merle Haggard and all that and his own. And there was a time where I didn't know which was which. It was just all blended in as what I thought were great songs. I'd say probably somewhere in my mid to late teens, I started catching on that, okay, that's the Hank stuff, and there's the Johnny Cash stuff, and really starting to see his songs, which were his. And actually, it took there was one song, which is the title of the record, This Weary Way. I didn't know that that was not a Hank Williams song until my late 20s. It just seemed so perfectly Hank in terms of style, in terms of structure, and that may be my, from my opinion, my dad's best song. And so that's one that took me an extra 10 years to figure out that it wasn't Hank's.
Wayne Scott, why didn't you make it more clear to your sons that you were writing songs?
I decided to try to be a singer instead of a writer. I tried singing my songs once, and I didn't like the cold feet and cold shoulder I got singing them.
And he's talking about a club. I mean, we used to play clubs like when I was a teenager. So he's talking about a night playing in a bar, you know, where they come to dance and drink and play five sets a night as far as the band is concerned. So that's what he's referring to, you know, that he did his songs one night. And, you know, of course, they wouldn't know the songs and wondering why he's not doing, you know, the top 10 of the country music at that time. So I think that was his brush with trying out new, you know, his material out in public.
Did you give up after one shot at it?
Yeah. I've never done it again. Now that's all I do, and it's great. I'm glad that he talked me into doing it, and it's a new experience to me, and people actually listen to me, too.
Well, you very, very generously offered to perform a duet for us, so I'd like to ask you to do a song that Wayne Scott, you do on your CD. And it's called Sunday with My Son, and it's a song that you wrote. Let me ask you to tell us what you're talking about in the song. It seems to be a song that directly comes out of your life.
Every word of it's the truth. That's the only way I can write. I only have inspiration. I don't have no education. Not that it's a gripe. I chose it. But my son was... the youngest one. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and I had him one Sunday afternoon for 3 hours, and we chose, I just love nature, so we went out into the woods to gather leaves and pine cones and things like that, and it was so beautiful, the song started going. I had to keep turning my back to him to not let him see the old man crying, and come up with that song. So by the next morning, I had all of it, and it said exactly what I wanted it to say, and this is it.
So
you want to hear it now?
I actually want to hear it now, yeah.
Okay. 1, 2.
As I look back on some bitter years, some things don't mean a thing. Like chasing women, writing songs, riding trucks and old freight trains. When I reach back for happy thoughts of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most is a Sunday with my son. From the mouths of little children comes truth and honesty. And this I kept remembering as we gathered autumn leaves. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most was a Sunday with my son. Fill his heart with happiness the way that he fills mine. But you just can't make up 10 lost years in just 3 hours' time. Reflections calls for happy thoughts when it does. Well, I've got one. One thing that I remember most of a Sunday with my son. From the mouths of little children comes truth and honesty. And this I kept remembering as I gathered autumn leaves. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most was a Sunday with my son. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most is Sunday with my son. Sunday with my son. Sunday with my son.
Oh, thank you for doing that. That's Wayne Scott singing and playing and guitar, and his son Daryl Scott accompanying him on banjo. And Daryl, thank you for bringing your father to our attention.
Absolutely, know,
by
truly
recording
my
him
pleasure.
And pushing him forward like that, like that.
So, truly my pleasure.
So Daryl, you have actually been able to make your career in music, both as a performer and as a songwriter. I mean, you as a songwriter, you've had several hits on the top of the Billboard Country chart.
Mm-hmm.
Did watching your father when you were growing up, watching him perform, but making a living all kinds of other ways, from working in the steel mill, I think, and
mm-hmm. steel mills and fence construction,
yeah,
delivering oil and mm-hmm. all sorts of things,
and moving around the country. So uh-huh. watching him do that and just kind of playing on the side, did you think, well, me, I want to really play professionally and make my life playing?
Yeah, I think I kind of knew that even as a kid. It just was, I wouldn't say easy for me, but it came naturally. It was like a natural thing for me to gravitate toward and to play. And because I grew up in a family band. My dad, of course, played and sang and wrote, and I had older brothers who played and younger brothers. And, you know, it was just the kind of what you do as a family, how some will go camping or fishing or into baseball or whatever. And our thing really was to play music. And so I was kind of, online for that really from the age of 6. I started playing. And, because our family business was fence construction, which is a really hard labor out in the sun kind of thing. I also learned, you know, at about 11 or 12, that it was better for me to stay home. And while the others were working, someone needed to answer the phone and cook. We were a bunch of bachelors, basically. My brothers and I lived with my dad. And so I was the cook, and so I found a way to get out of hard labor actually pretty early. And I just kind of kept that up. I'm still not into hard labor.
Wayne Scott, when your sons were born, did you look at them one by one and think, this is going to be my band?
Yep. That's why.
Yeah, he absolutely did.
They're all D's.
Yeah, all your sons, their names all start with the letter D. Why is that?
Yeah, that was for that reason. And they're...
What, so you could start a band with them?
Yeah. And their introduction to music was when they come home, I laid them in the bed and stood over them and played Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, played with them about an hour or so. So you wouldn't wake up when you heard me singing at 2 in the morning, you know, and for those reasons.
Well, we were used to it.
Oh, that's funny.
They can sleep right through country music, or they can play it. Daryl, you knew he was a musician, I'd say at 3, and all the boys are professional, but Daryl's the best. I mean, if it's got strings on it, he can play it. And at 3 years old, it was vivid that that he wouldn't be no fence builder.
So how did having sons whose names each started with the letter D help you in playing music or creating a band? I mean, I don't get that
part. I was going to name them the 2 Ds, the 3 Ds, the 4 Ds, or however many Ds it took. It's all going to be Ds, you know.
So Wayne Scott and the 4 Ds, the 5 Ds, yeah.
That's the way it came. And honestly, that was the reason. I was determined they'd be musicians.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks,
Terry.
Wayne Scott and his son, Daryl Scott, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The father's album, produced by his son, is called This Weary Way. This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our Father's Day salute with jazz saxophonist Branford Marsalis, brother of Wynton and son of the great jazz pianist and teacher Ellis Marsalis. As a kid, Branford spent more time listening to Elton John and Led Zeppelin than he did checking out the music that his dad was into. But Branford now has a long string of jazz albums to his name, as well as some genre-busting efforts, including his group Buckshot LaFunk, which combines jazz and hip-hop. In the pop world, he's performed with Sting, The Dead, and Bruce Hornsby, and for a few years led Jay Leno's Tonight Show band. Terry spoke with Branford in 2002.
You grew up in what is now America's probably most famous jazz family, the Marsalis family. Your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist. When you were growing up liking the pop music that you liked, did you feel about his music the way, say, I felt about my father's old Benny Goodman records?
I felt about my father's music the way that my next-door neighbor felt about his father, the chauffeur driver. That was just what he did.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about your father's
Benny
Goodman records?
Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't. Oh, I really disliked them until I got much older. Well, in my 20s, anyways.
Jazz is not for kids. And I know there's an argument. My brother says jazz can be for kids. I don't think jazz has a level of sophistication that's just way too hip for kids. It's not a music for kids, and it certainly wasn't a music for me. But it wasn't like he'd play them and I'd go, arr. I would just leave the room.
He just didn't care.
And turn on the television in the other room until it was my turn to listen to my music. And then I'd put on Cheech and Chong and Elton John and, you know, James Brown and whatever I wanted to put on. And my father would stay out. And then when James Brown came on, he'd come in and say, yeah, kid, yeah, Jack, I like that. And then he would always dance to it. When he danced to it, he would snap his fingers on 2 and 4, which was the funniest thing in the world. You know,
that's great.
You know, yeah, cold sweats going on, you know. Mm-hmm. Like a cold sweat, dun, 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 do, ba, do, do, dee, dee. My father's going, yeah. I'm like, no, Dad. It's just funny.
It's on the one.
Oh, yeah. It was classic.
Oh, that's great. So what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was the piano. And then when I was a freshman, when I was in the first grade or second grade, went and started playing the trumpet. And I wanted to play an instrument. So I said, I want to play the trumpet. And my father says, no, we're not going to have two people playing the same instrument in the same household. So you have to pick something else. So, okay, clarinet. Okay, fine, you get the clarinet. And I played the clarinet for 7 years until I was a sophomore in high school, and then I switched to the alto saxophone because I wanted to be in a funk band.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are no clarinets in funk bands.
And if there were, it would be really bad. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a good vibe at all.
So tell me, has your father been really pleased over the years that you've come to love jazz and play it?
Now he does. But my whole career to him was just one, because my dad he has two words. I mean, he always said, I mean, like typical Ellis Marsalis fashion, he says, yeah, man, you know, you and Wynton are interesting because, see, Wynton's a concrete sequential and you're a random abstract. I actually named a record in Random Abstract because he was saying, I said, what are you talking about, man? Just talk to me like I'm your son. What was this concrete sequential crap, you know? And he went through it, you know, went just things like A, B, C, D, E, F, and you're like A, F, B, Z. And he just didn't understand that, because if you have to really, he's a concrete sequential. So it just seemed like, it seemed just rampant, just like a pell-mell kind of thing. Like, what in the hell is he doing? I mean, I just confused the hell out of my poor dad.
Branford Marsalis, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. He concludes our special Father's Day salute. So on behalf of fathers everywhere, and of daughters and sons who love them, happy Father's Day this weekend. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.